Well, thank you for inviting me, and thank you for the great honor to give me the first talk. I would like to say a few things about Jerry. Very few. We've met a long time ago. It's still a surprise to me that it's your 60th birthday now. And I would like to recall the most memorable outing we had together, which was, well, to me, it was a trip to the Ticino. Remember that? I told Jerry that's the southern part of Switzerland. It's Mediterranean, lots of sun, good food. Well, good food we had, I think. But we had 3 days straight of rain. Never lifted enough for us to see the mountains. The greatest thing we did see was a big rainbow on a very black. Yeah. I brought a picture of the Ticino in the rain. It's just unfortunately the computer won't show it to you. So, well, it wasn't just as bad as it really was. So I thought I would give you something instead. And you know, this is a canned version of Ticino. It does not have one single rainy picture. But remember, we decided we would go back there under better conditions. But that trip took place 25 years ago, so I thought maybe a canned version would be just... Well, I did probably... No, we have met in nice weather. It's happened to us. So I would like to tell you about representations of quivers and invariants and also semi-invariants. And throughout the talk, I will work over an algebraically closed field. A quiver, that's just an oriented graph. Everything is finite. So it's got finitely many vertices, which I number from 1 through n, and finitely many arrows. And I will say that the tail of alpha, I will call the tail of alpha T alpha and the head of alpha H alpha. A representation of Q that's a finite family of vector spaces. I vector space together with a family of linear maps. One for each arrow. And the morphism between two representations, well, I won't write it, I'll just say it. Maybe, well, f from x to y, that's a family fi. To yi, such that the squares you can see, one for each arrow. Commute. So here is fi, here is fj, and all these squares commute. Now you can add up representations of quivers, you can form direct sums. And for that, you just take the direct sums of the vector spaces, and for the maps, you take the diagonal maps. A representation is called indecomposable if its only decomposition as a direct sum has one summand, which is zero. And there is an important fact, Kohl-Schmidt theorem, which tells you that every representation is a direct sum of indecomposables, and that decomposition is essentially unique. It's unique up to isomorphism.
compose. Oh, I should put, maybe can put it here, the dimension vector of x. That's an element in just the vector dimension of x1 to dimension of
x. Now the easiest example you all know is the quiver. Well, there is an even easier one, but the easiest non-trivial one is the quiver, which is just a loop. And what's a representation? It's one square matrix. What's an indecomposable representation? It's one which in its Jordan normal form has only one block. And there you all know from linear algebra that every matrix is equivalent to a matrix formed by Jordan blocks. And that would be the Kohl-Schmidt theorem telling you that the eigenvalues and the sizes of the blocks are uniquely determined by the matrix. Now, I would like to consider the set of representations representation of Q for which the vector spaces I associate to every vertex are fixed and even fixed with the basis. So what's the representation in here? The only thing I need to determine are the linear maps for the arrows. So this is product of matrix spaces. It is a vector space. Affine space. And on that affine variety, there are two groups acting, GAB. That's the product of the GLDIs, one for each vertex, and also SLD, the product of the SLs, and the action is given in the following way. If I want to know what an n-tuple of matrices does to a representation, that's GJ X alpha GI inverse if alpha is an arrow from I to J. So you see G will be a morphism from X to G of X. And in fact, the orbit on the GL of some representation X in here consists just of the representations in here which are isomorphic to X. So first, small geometric fact, G of X GL B of X is closed with respect to the Tsarivsky topology. I always work with the Tsarivsky topology on this set here. X is a semi-simple representation. Now, why is that? I would like to give you a small indication of the proof. Every orbit closure contains exactly one closed orbit. And if X is not semi-simple, you will find a short exact sequence, not split. And that means that X of alpha, so if alpha is an arrow, X of alpha will be will have a triangular form like this. If I choose a basis for x of I, which starts with a basis for x prime of I and then ends with a basis for x double prime of I. Now if I take T, a non-zero scalar, I want to replace the basis in here, in the first part, by T times the basis, and keep the basis, oh, sorry, this should be an alpha here, and keep the basis in the x double prime part fixed, and that will have the effect that nothing changes in that matrix except this part in the top right corner here, and this part will be multiplied by T. So you see that in the same orbit as X, you will get all these representations for non-zero T, and you will see, you see also that in the closure of the orbit, you have the representation for T equals zero, which is the semi-simple, the direct sum of X prime and X double prime, and that is not isomorphic to X since I chose a non-split sequence. So the semi-simple ones are the only ones which have a chance to have a closed orbit, and they actually do have closed orbits. Now, what are semi-simple representations or simple representations of a quiver? That depends on whether Q contains closed orbits, oriented cycles, excuse me. If Q does not contain oriented cycles, there are just finitely many simples, one for each vertex. And they are one-dimensional. And what is a semi-simple representation then? Well, X in rep QD. Semi-simple. If and only if it is zero, all the matrices are the zero matrix if I view it in the space up here. All arrows are represented by zero. So there's one semi-simple representation in rep QD in case Q does not contain oriented cycles. The situation is very different if there are oriented cycles. Then there are infinitely many simple representations. That's also something you know in this easiest example. Where is it? Of the loop. You get a simple, a one-dimensional representation of the loop for each scalar k. So this is the example I would like to look at. Example of what? Well, if you have a vector space with the regular action of a reductive group, then the ring of invariance, the ring of invariant polynomials under this group action will be a finitely generated algebra. This is Hilbert's theorem, and it will be the algebra of functions of some affine variety, VG. VG is called the algebraic quotient.
of V by G, and it, well, the quotient map T from V is not quite a quotient, it's almost a quotient, it parametrizes closed orbits, not all orbits. Now this pair VG is called coregular if V modulo G has no singularities. It's equidimensional if all fibers of pi have the same dimension. Which is then the difference of the dimension of V minus the dimension of V modulo G. And it's actually enough for the zero fiber, so pi inverse of pi of zero, to be of that dimension, then all fibers will be of that dimension. And the pair is called co-free if KV is a free module over the invariant ring. Jerry proved in his big IEHS paper that the first two imply the third. Huh? No. Well, okay, we'll talk about it. Well, you showed that both of them are equivalent in many cases anyway. Okay. So Jerry classified coregular and co-free representations for simple connected groups, and Peter Littlemann classified irreducible representations also for semi-simple algebraic groups. Now this example is, well, the group is semi-simple and it's very rarely an irreducible representation. In fact, you get a sub-representation for each arrow. So often they are not irreducible. So I would like to tell you first a little bit what can be said about GLD invariance in that context. GLD. If Q does not contain oriented cycles, there is one semi-simple representation, so there are only constants which are invariant. The invariant theory is not very interesting. Okay. And if Q does contain oriented cycles, the invariants have been determined by Lebrun and Procesi, at least in characteristic zero. They can be described in the following way. GLD is generated by the traces of X of V, and V is a cycle from some closed cycle starting at some point I and ending at some point I. Now you know this, well this is easy to understand if Q is an oriented cycle. Then there is one DI which is, say, call it D. minimum of the dj. To n, and I want consider v just the path going through every vertex once from I to I. So and the coefficients, if I look at the characteristic polynomial minus x of v, that will be a polynomial of degree d whose coefficients plus cd of x. C1 through cd will be GLD invariants and they will be generators. And moreover, they are algebraically independent. So in this case, the algebraic quotient is just k to the power d. And if you go away from just one oriented cycle, if you take more complicated quivers containing oriented cycles, not much is known about whether the representation is coregular or not. It gets complicated very easily. That's actually the advantage we have with this example, is that I can use methods from representation theory of quivers to answer geometric questions. It's always worked in this way. In the beginning, the hope was that geometry would help to answer questions about representation theory, but that hasn't, well, it hasn't happened so frequently. So it's more accessible to methods from representation theory is the action of SLD and ZQD. Well, a character on GLD is a regular map from GLD to K star, which is also a group homomorphism. And what you get is just Z to the N, because a character on GLN or GLM, just the matrix group, is a power of the determinant. And you get one such character for each factor in GLD. If I take such a character F in K rep QD, it's called a semi-invariant of weight chi if G times F is just a multiple of F and the multiple in question is given by the character. If I want to look at all SL invariants, SLD, then there is a weight space decomposition of this algebra coming from the fact that the center of GLD is a torus. You get one copy of K star for each vertex, and that torus acts on this vector space. And if you consider the weight space decomposition, you will find GLD. Well, that you get a direct sum, and every sum and is a space of semi-invariants. This is semi-invariant of weight chi. Well,
And that's why I will tell you about semi-invariants, and they will give us all SLD invariants. So how do you get semi-invariants? The recipe for that comes from, has been given by Aidan Schofield. Oh, okay. I will choose X in rep QB and Y QB, and they will give me a map from this vector space to the product over all arrows. From K D I K E J, and the map, well, maybe it's still a little bit visible down here. I defined morphisms between representations by saying that there was a square which is commute. I'll put it back. And Fj down here. And the map Fxy just measures how far the square is from commuting. The square I get from sending F1 to Fn. Y alpha Fi minus Fjx alpha. So this will be a linear map from this vector space to that one. And by definition, the kernel of this map is just Q linear maps from X to Y. And the co-kernel is quite easy to describe as well. The co-kernel is X1, YX, no, X. 0. I don't think I have the time to explain that to you. You've seen it a little bit before up there. If you take Z alpha in here and you send it to that matrix up there, you will obtain an extension from X to Y just by setting that in the middle term to take this matrix there with the Z alphas. And if you send that extension to the X1, XY, you will see that the map is surjective and its kernel, the co-boundaries are exactly the image of FXY. So now suppose that the two vector spaces in the middle have the same dimension. I'll write that differently. I will define the Euler bilinear form. On q to the power n, and I will give you the values on n to the power n dE is the sum dI e I over all vertices minus the sum over all alphas dI dj. Do you see it's just the difference of the dimensions of the two spaces at both ends of fxy? So dE
is 0 if and only if fx1 is a square matrix.
And you can see something else. You can also see that dE is, well,
is the dimension of hom xy minus the dimension of x1 xy.
And this is, well, dE, this scalar product, depends only on dimension vectors, and here we get something that depends on x and y within those spaces. This shows that
the result, I will use these abbreviations,
the result you get from computing hom xy minus x xy, the dimensions, will be independent of the actual representations you chose and just depend on the dimension vectors d and d. Now, if we suppose that d is 0, fxy is a square matrix, and that is the source, Schofield source of semi-invariance, I choose d e 0 and some representation y in rep q d. Fy not the determinant of that, excuse me. This polynomial function on the representation space can be easily seen to be a semi-invariant on the GLD. In fact, you could even construct a semi-invariant for the actions of both GLD and GLE simultaneously, but we'll need only this part. So this is semi-invariant. But it can be 0. And the next question is, when is it non-zero? Well, you can see it here. That's the case if there is a representation x for which the determinant of fxy does not vanish. And when is that? That's if the map up there fxy is bijective. And the perp. That's the y to d with xy equals 0. So you get this condition, and d perpendicular, that's a full subcategory of the representations of Q. It's closed under direct summands, direct sums, images, kernels, co-kernels. It's an abelian subcategory of the category of representations of Q. Unfortunately, it usually has infinitely many simple objects. So it's not so easy to deal with, but it is easy to deal with in the... Oh, I would like to tell you one more thing before I go to the case when it is easy to deal with. If I have
my double prime zero is a short exact sequence. Everybody in here, y prime, y double prime in the perp, then it is quite easy to see that the invariance you get from the middle term will be the product of the invariance you get from the two terms at both ends. So in fact, you will get a generating set for the semi-invariance by just considering y to be a simple object in the perp. And that's why it's interesting to know what the simple objects are. And now I'm going to tell you about the case in which the perp has only finitely many simple objects, and that if Rep2D contains a dense open orbit. Special case. For GL. Now this is a very strong condition on D, unless you know something about the quiver. So if Q has, well, is what's called a Dinkin quiver, that means that the underlying graph of Q is a disjoint union of Dinkin diagrams. Then Gabriel showed that there are only finitely many indecomposables. So RepQD will contain only finitely many isomorphism classes of representations, and one of them will have to be open. So in that case, always satisfied. But if you look at general quivers and general dimension vectors, mostly there won't be an open orbit. So I take T in this open orbit and I write it as a direct sum of indecomposables. Pairwise non-isomorphic. Oh, I forgot to tell you before. I could have told you here. No, I can tell you now. Now I'm going to write that GLDT has a dense orbit in here. If you compare dimensions, then you will find what's the dimension of the orbit. The dimension of the orbit is the dimension of GLD. Minus the dimension of the isotropic group. But the isotropic group in GLD are the automorphisms of T, and that's open in the vector space of endomorphisms of T. So here are the endomorphisms of T. And that has to have the same dimension as rep QD. So now if you write that this is the sum of the di squared, and this is the sum over all arrows of di dj, what you get is that the Euler bilinear form, if you evaluate it on d and d, it's the sum of the di squared minus the sum of the di dj. That's just
PT, but we saw before that this bilinear form always will give you the value, the dimension of the endomorphism ring of T minus the dimension of X1, T with T. So that's one way of seeing that T has no self-extensions. Actually, all these arrows can be reversed. The condition that T has an open orbit is equivalent to saying that T has no self-extensions. Thank you. Even better. Oh, yeah. And from that, it's again easy to conclude that the number of direct summands you have in T is at most n, the number of vertices that you have in your quiver. So, 1, T, T is 0. That obviously implies R is this R here, the number of direct summands in T. Summands in T is at most N. And I will tell you the argument, but I won't write it. If you have T with no self-extension, so this here, the reason is that are linearly independent in Q to the N. So if you take the dimension vectors of these indecomposable direct summands, they will be linearly independent in Q to the N. And why is that? So suppose you have a rational linear combination of those which vanishes. First you get rid of the denominators, and then you put summands with positive sign to one side, with negative sign to the other side, and you will get two dimension vectors in which, well, the same actually, two versions of realizing the open orbit in a vector space. But in a vector space, the open orbit is unique. So there is only one way to realize it, and that will give you that these must be linearly independent. So the fewer summands than N, and now I can tell you Schofield's result. If T has an open orbit, and this thing, well, I don't need that here. This category D perpendicular has N minus R simple objects S1 through Sn minus R. So this abelian category, which I told you about before, has exactly N minus R simple objects. They all give you semi-invariance. If T is sincere, and that means Tx is, it's a condition which is just, well, if you have a representation which doesn't live on the whole quiver, you just take a smaller quiver and it will have an open orbit there, then the semi-invariance or the SL invariance are generated by
F S1 through F Sn minus R, and these are algebraically independent. I already told you why you only needed to consider semi-invariants coming from simple objects. Schofield proved, actually, it wasn't using results by Sato Kimura and also by Katz, proved that the semi-invariants you get in this way, which I described to you, generate all semi-invariants, and moreover, they are algebraically independent. So this representation will be this vector space with SL acting will be co-regular. Next question is, when is it equidimensional? And the first one to consider this question of two people were Carol Chang and Jersey Wayman. Consider this case, this question for a quiver whose underlying graph is AN. And they found out that you always get an equidimensional representation. That's not always true, not even for all Dynkin quivers. I show an example to you. And it fails. It's the first example which is not AN. Example. I take a D4 quiver, alpha, beta, gamma, and I write the dimension type I want to consider instead of the vertices. So it's a dimension type 2 in the center and 1 all around. As always, there is an open orbit, as always for Dynkin quivers. In this case, open orbit. So T has an open orbit. T of alpha, T of beta, T of gamma are pairwise linearly independent. What are the semi-invariants in this case? I don't want to go through the whole perpendicular category computations, I'll tell you in another way. Sato and Kimura proved that if there is an open orbit, the semi-invariants are given by the irreducible components of the complement of that open orbit, which are of codimension 1. So we look at the complement of the open orbit, and you see right away that it has three irreducible components, all of codimension 1. They are given by saying that you want T alpha and T beta to be linearly dependent, or T alpha, T gamma, or T beta, T gamma. And you see the count is right. Here, this is generically an indecomposable representation, so we should expect 4 minus 1, which is 3 semi-invariants, and here they are. These are the 3 semi-invariants. Now, equidimensional means look at the representations here on which all three semi-invariants vanish. And we hope it will be of codimension 3. So what is this set on which all three semi-invariants vanish? Well, you see right away that if you look at the matrix, then the vanishing of all three semi-invariants means that the rank of this is not T now. I should call it some other letter, X, is at most 1. So, x
and what's the dimension of that set? Well, you all know if you look at 2 by 3 matrices of rank at most 1, you get 4 parameters. So this set is of codimension 2, but we got 3 semi-invariants, so it's not equidimensional.
And what is surprising is that, well, I'll write it down for you. If you take twice that dimension vector, it will be equidimensional, and it will remain equidimensional ever after. And this is true not only for Dynkin diagrams, but whenever you have an open orbit. And this is joint work with Gregor Svara from Torun.
If rect QD contains an open orbit, there is a N. Well, I should write it T. Such that if lambda I is at least N for all I, then rep Q N times D SL N times D is equidimensional.
So the situation gets better if you take a bigger dimension vector, and that was surprising to us in the beginning, because in Jerry's and also in Peter Littlemann's classification you got something equidimensional only for very small representations. There is more to this. We have not much information about this N in general. There is one more surprising thing. If you go one step, even if you take lambda I one bigger, then you will get something irreducible. So the fiber of zero will be irreducible. Often just the closure of one orbit, but not always. And if we look at special quivers again, extended Dynkin quivers or Dynkin quivers this time, so if Q is AN or AN tilde, N is 1. So you will always have an equidimensional situation, and that is coincides with what Chung and Raymond found. If Q is dn or e, 7, 8, you need to take 2. And if Q is an extended Dynkin diagram, other than an tilde, you need n equals 3. It's very surprising, so it's not true in the beginning, but starting at some n, it will be an equidimensional situation. Now, I don't know. I didn't look when I started, David.
Another 5 minutes.
Okay. Then I can tell you just a little bit about the situation. Well, just one situation. In which there is no open orbit. And that's also joint work with Svara, but we've only looked at extended Dynkin diagrams. No open orbit. Well, in that case, generically, orbits depend on parameters. Depend on, say, P parameters. And the first question is, what does the invariant ring look like? That has been done by Kovronsky and Weyman. If Q is, or P at least 2, then rep QD, the SL invariants are again a polynomial ring. For P equals 1, the situation is different. You get one equation. It's a complete intersection. So this question is, the answer is, it's good if P is at least 2. And we proved that if P, again, if Q is a n, or P is at least 3, we need to go 1 higher up, then the situation is again, well, plus a condition on multiplicities, which I don't want to explain. I can tell you a little bit what it is. If you look at extended Dynkin quivers and the case in which you don't have an open orbit, then you have representations depending on P parameters. That's almost like Jordan normal form. It's one part. But you also can add to these representations something from a situation in which there is an open orbit. And for those, you will need that the multiplicities of the direct sum and you add is also at least 3. So this is what I mean here, plus some other condition on multiplicities. Then SLD is equidimensional. What's different from the open orbit case is that here, the number of components, the number of irreducible components you get, will grow with P, except for the oriented cycle, in which case there is a bound, but the bound is not 1. I told you, but I didn't write it, in case there is an open orbit, if you let the dimension vector grow, so n, the multiples you take of each indecomposable, if you let that grow, you will eventually get something irreducible. Here, the number of components will grow. So just two words about methods. There are two ingredients. One ingredient is reflection functors. And the second ingredient is just induction. That's why we cannot generalize our results to more general quivers yet. The inductive part is, well, you just leave out one vertex, usually a sink, and you compare the situation you have for Q with the situation you have for the smaller quiver where you cancel this vertex and all arrows go into it. Okay, thank you for your attention.